The Accidental Entrepreneur is brought to you through our affiliate relationships with the following sponsors: Digital Accelerant, the digital mobile business card that generates leads. Text the word LAW to 21,000 to get connected and learn how to get your own digital business card. And by Fetch Internet and Fetch Pro, the secure, high-speed app that eliminates the need to pay for hotspots or use public unsecure Wi-Fi. And Printify, the online, on-demand print shop for all your corporate merchandise. Be sure to visit our online store and get your own podcast merch. Listen to all of our sponsors' commercials later in this episode and follow their links in the show notes to learn more about their products and services. The
question is,
like, why?
Is somebody going to use it in a way that would cause you economic injury?
Yeah, probably not.
I mean, yeah. in most cases, you want it to be out there.
Yeah.
You want people to be sharing your podcast, right? Because that helps you.
Right.
But exactly. If you were to the point where this turned out to be a huge moneymaker instead of just a small moneymaker,
right,
but a huge moneymaker,
right,
then it makes more sense now. If people are taking clips and they're claiming that they're Mitch, then
that's problematic.
You would want to stop.
Blow up my deal with Spotify for $50 million. Yeah. Okay. So you said there were four things though, right?
Right. So we did, well, we did copyrights. We did trademarks. That was the Coca-Cola stuff. We did the patents.
Right.
And finally is trade secrets, right?
Okay.
And so trade secrets are pretty kind of misunderstood, but they're still valuable IP tools. It's basically a trade secret is anything that's secret that gives you a commercial advantage. So
makes sense.
Lots of times, like recipes, you might want to.
We were saying the Coca-Cola formula, right?
Right. That was
trade
a
secret.
Exactly. Perfect.
Yeah, and, because you'd be an idiot to copyright that because everybody would know what the formula says. Right.
But you didn't give that.
The information provided in these episodes is for entertainment purposes only. It is not a guarantee of success or to be construed as advice of any kind. You should always seek advice from local licensed professionals before making any decisions.
The dictionary defines an entrepreneur as a person who organizes and manages any enterprise, especially a business, usually with considerable initiative and risk. People often start a business without much choice, perhaps due to a job loss or just being dissatisfied at work. And they come up with an idea they just know can be successful. They become entrepreneurs by accident. That is to say, their success or failure happens by accident, not with intention. My name is Mitch Beinhacker. I'm a corporate attorney and a business advisor. You're listening to The Accidental Entrepreneur, my podcast about how to achieve success on purpose, not by accident. Join me along with our monthly guests where we share our knowledge and help you get a hold of your business. And now on to today's episode. Just to remind you, the podcast is produced and brought to you by my legal practice, Beinhacker Law. We provide business and estate services to entrepreneurs, inventors, and other small business owners. Whether you're just getting started or you've been operating for a long time, contact us for all your general legal needs, from contracts to client agreements, from purchasing a new location to onboarding a new partner or key employee. We draft all types of agreements and handle most business transactions. For more information about our products and services, visit beinhackerlaw.com or you can follow our link in the show notes. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoyed today's interview.
Hi, everyone. I'm Richard Gearhart, founder of Gearhart Law, full-service intellectual property law firm. We're headquartered in Summit, New Jersey, and we have offices in Philadelphia as well as New York City. And I've been a patent professional for over 30 years now, and Gearhart Law has started about 15 years ago, and we have 14 collaborators on our team, and we love to help entrepreneurs with their intellectual property issues.
All right, Richard. So I thank you for coming on the podcast. I also thank you for having me on your show on iHeartRadio. And is it WOR or 710, right? That was a lot of fun.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. You were great.
And thank your wife, too, for having me on her fireside chat thing for attorneys.
She says the best things about you, Mitch.
Yeah, she's a real marketing machine, huh?
Yeah, she sure is.
She's doing a lot of stuff. I was just talking to somebody, my friend Fred, who runs my Wednesday morning group, and he had met her at some Morristown tech startup group or something, I guess, that she's involved with.
There used to be a Morristown meetup, and that used to be before COVID. when you could actually go out and meet people, that was one of the local tech groups. And we participated there for a long, long time. Right. And but now everything has changed.
So. Yeah, there's going to be the term BCV, right? Before coronavirus is going to be marking things in history. That's what's going to happen. But all right. So maybe you could tell me a little bit about, you know, your background and, you know, where you've worked and how you got into law, because then I want to get into all the intellectual stuff that most small business owners would be dealing with.
Okay, great. Well, I'll keep it as short and
succinct. We've got an hour, so don't rush too much.
Yeah, so, I started my career as a chemist. I worked for the B.F. Goodrich Company.
Okay.
And after working there, I decided to go to law school.
That's the company that had those funny commercials, the Goodrich blimp. And then the guy goes, Goodrich doesn't have a blimp, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
You've got a good memory.
Right. Okay.
And so anyway, I ended up going to law school. I was only sort of half into the idea, but it was sort of a recession and, you know, people were getting laid off. I was in Cleveland, Ohio, of all places.
Okay. So you're like, let's go back to school, right?
Well, yeah. So why not go back to school?
Right.
And I always loved Perry Mason. He was my inspiration. I thought if I went to law school, I'd be cross-examining.
It's all like that, right? That's what people think. Yeah.
Yeah. And of course, it doesn't ever work that way.
If now, we're watching that show, Suits, right now. You know, Suits with Meghan Markle, with my wife.
She's I've seen that.
Not like this. I go, of course it's not. There's nothing like law would be boring. If you did really what you did at a law firm in a TV show, nobody would watch.
I know. It's like, remember, take your kid to work day. I bring my kid to work and I say, well, these are the file cabinets. We put all the documents in.
Right. Go sit in the kitchen and color.
Printer.
Yeah. My daughter said, can you take me to work? She's a teenager. I go, what are you going to do? There's nothing to do. You're going to sit here and watch me the whole day? It's not, you know, it's not like we're having like a big company, right, where they do a picnic out on the lawn for all the kids and they got clowns and make it a big right. day of it. We don't do that. We're small business owners. So that's funny. So, okay.
Anyway, so right, but that's not what I had in my head, and I never knew any attorneys. I knew one attorney.
Okay.
But I didn't really know what it was like, and so, but it just seemed like a logical step for me.
Right.
And so I ended up going to Case Western Reserve Law School.
Sure.
After that, I went to Switzerland.
Is Case Western in Cleveland?
It's in Cleveland, Ohio.
Oh, okay.
It is. And it's where the presidential debates were.
Right.
For some reason,
I thought that was like in Colorado is where Case Western was, but I guess I'm
wrong. Yeah, no, it's in Cleveland.
Yeah.
And so after that, I went to Switzerland. I studied at the Graduate Institute of International Studies, and they have sort of a master's degree in international law. Okay. And it's right sort of in the center of all of the UN complex there. And so I thought, well, maybe I'll go work for the UN or I'll do something. I ended up taking a job at Jones Day, which is this big multinational law firm. They had an office in Switzerland.
Okay.
And I did corporate deals and international arbitration. And
wow. International, so you're working on big stuff.
Is, you know, where companies from different countries
right.
fight it out over
stuff.
Yeah, so
you're working on big stuff.
Yeah, they were big, big cases. One of the cases was between Alcon, and they had, this was back in 1990. Alcon, a French telecom company, had sold the Chinese a bunch of switching equipment for telephones. And the guy who sold it got into a dispute with the telecom company because he wanted his commission, which was like 2%. But the sales were like, you know, $10 billion.
Right. 2% was a lot of money.
So, and 2% was like pretty important to him.
Yeah. A year's salary, probably. Right.
So anyway, I did that for a while and then finished up my degree, came back, came to Chicago, worked for a boutique IP law firm, and then eventually went on the corporate side. I worked for Dow Corning Corporation, which is now part of Dow, but that mm-hmm. was a joint venture between Dow Corning and Corning Glass.
Right.
And I learned a lot about industrial kind of chemistry. I was there for 7 years. I became a manager. I left because they were in bankruptcy over the silicone breast implant controversy. Wow. And I just did not see that as being a good place to be. And so we ended up in Atlanta at a company called Ciba Vision that made contact lenses.
Okay.
It was part of Novartis, a subsidiary of Novartis. And I was there for, I don't know, 5-6 years. And then eventually ended up heading up the intellectual property group for Novartis Pharmaceuticals here in New Jersey.
So that's how you started getting into intellectual property.
So all of that, it was intellectual property. That whole time was just, when I went to the boutique firm in Chicago, that was intellectual property. And I knew after like doing it for 2 weeks that this was my calling. This was my profession that I was going to be doing it the rest of my life. I just really liked it. I liked the technology. I liked the documents. I liked the fact that there's international pieces to intellectual property. There's international patents. There's agreement work. There's litigation. You could work for the government. You could work for a
corporation. Plus you had a technical degree, right? Don't you need a technical degree to join the patent bar? I couldn't do it. I was an economics major, right?
Well, that might be.
They're more liberal nowadays.
It's not too late.
Okay. But no, I'll let you do it. That's okay.
You'll stay with what you know.
Right.
I have a chemistry degree. So my specialty is really life sciences. So medical devices, pharmaceutical products.
Right.
But the firm as a whole works in all technology areas. We work in software. We work in consumer products. We work with inventors. We have a couple of larger companies as clients in the Fortune 500. So we really do soup to nuts. We work with anyone. Our hearts are really with the entrepreneurs. When I left Novartis, I was kind of just tired of the corporate attitude, and I wanted to do something different and better. And so we started Gearhart Law with the hope that we could help people escape from that environment if that was their desire. And I'm proud to say now that we have over 2,000 clients that we've served over the last 15 years.
So that's when you went out on your own 15 years ago?
Yeah. And most of it has just been getting the word out or referrals, some advertising.
Yeah, well, you guys are good marketers, though. You're out there stuff.
You thank my wife for that. So
okay, well, whatever. You're lucky to have your wife, but I think a lot of us as lawyers, we gain no business skills. Nobody trains us how to do marketing and business development. You know, IP attorneys, I guess, put billboards up on the highway, but we really don't have any form. It doesn't count for continuing legal education. It should.
That's true. It should.
There should be business courses that you can take where most attorneys have small practices. You need to learn how to run your practice, grow your practice, and market, and all the things that you, and you know, even from a social media standpoint, how do you work through the ethics rules in terms of all of that stuff and run your business? And it just doesn't seem like we get a lot of that kind of stuff.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of attorneys in the legal profession who want to be traditional attorneys, and they want to do things the old way. And in some ways, it's not so bad that the legal system, you know, judges aren't texting and, on Facebook and all this other stuff.
Right.
Because
obviously that creates issues. Right.
Yeah. They're very conservative. The profession, maybe not politically, but in terms of its mindset, is slow to change. And that's good because society needs parts of the society that are slow to change. And the legal system is sort of like the backbone, right?
Right.
The rest of the body can move around, but that's the framework that kind of keeps it all together. So so there's a lot of people who don't want to market.
And right.
I've talked with other the best information is always talking to somebody else's legal assistant.
Right.
And they'll tell you, I put this spreadsheet in front of my boss. He doesn't want anything to do with knowing what the numbers are. He just wants to practice law. He doesn't care. Right,
but isn't that crazy? If it's your own practice, you need to know your numbers.
Yeah, well, I agree with you. I think you're right.
We all suffer from, entrepreneurial poverty as lawyers. None of us are going to retire. We're going to work till we're 92. There's a guy, he's a very nice guy. He's in my office here. He had downsized whatever because it's co-working space. He's 86 years old and he's still working. And I don't think he's going to retire.
Yeah.
Of course, he has nine kids.
That'll be me.
But yeah, right. It'll probably be me too. My uncle's in Morristown. He's in his 60s. He doesn't plan on retiring any soon. I mean, I don't know if we're ever going to retire. We'll work less maybe. balance your quality of life. You know, it's not like the old days where you just like walk over the sunset 65, you die when you're 72. That's not going to happen. So, you know, it's a little bit different, but that's my struggles with the business is that we don't get a lot of business training. And you're right. There are people that don't want to do it, but I think some of it is like, they don't want to do it because they're afraid of it. Or I don't think that they have too much business to deal with. I don't find any of those people, you know, that they have so much business that they don't need to market.
No, I think you always need to market. You always got to, I mean, if you want to keep the work coming in.
Right. You guys have a huge clientele and a big business. Would you ever think of stopping marketing? Well, of course, your wife would kick you in the head, but you know what I mean? It doesn't even occur to you. It's not in your fiber.
No, it really doesn't. And even if you're a large firm with institutional clients, you've got to be out there talking to them, creating seminars for their in-house counsel that they want to go to, getting them tickets to the ball game for when their cousin comes into town.
You don't want to lose that piece of business.
Yeah. So even if you're not, you know, signing new engagement letters every week, you still have to market to your current clients to keep them, you know, engaged.
You know, we know firms have gone under, right? They lose one big major client. And they got to let 70% of their attorneys go.
Yeah.
It's a dangerous way to live, but whatever.
Yeah. Well, that's, we've decided, you know, we've decided that, there's two sides to that coin, right? If you work with a lot of entrepreneurs, you have a lot of, smaller clients, which is delightful. That's what we want. But there's also a lot of administration that goes with that.
Yeah.
And you do have to spend more, I think, marketing time.
Right.
You know, instead of just meeting with one client a week, I'm meeting with a lot of clients a week.
Right.
Right. And a lot of potential clients.
Plus some go out of business. You got to replace them, things. Yeah.
And so, and if they're smaller, they may have one or two projects. So you have to constantly have new business coming in.
Right.
But if that model works, then you can, then you can sustain yourself if a client leaves.
Right. Not as big of a hit.
Yeah. And on the other hand, what you said is just completely right a few minutes ago. If you're a one trick pony, one client or a couple big clients and one of them goes, which many eventually do, right, then you're scurrying around trying to figure out how to pay your bills.
Yeah, right? There was a firm in Morristown. I forget the firm. I think they did a lot of education law. And maybe their big client was like the city of Elizabeth or something. And there was a political change. They lost the business. And I know a lot of friends got laid off.
Yeah, that's too
bad. Tough way to live. Yeah, yeah. So let's talk about, I mean, you and I could talk about marketing and stuff like all day long. But, you know, about intellectual property, because I think one of the problems that I run into with a lot of small business owners that I work with, because I'm the general counsel, I'm not the specific counsel, I guess, is that people don't understand the rules, protect their intellectual property. I could give you some examples as we talk about it. I have a case right now that I'm wondering what happens with their intellectual property. Mm-hmm. And, you know, patents being the secondary issue, but, you know, really protecting the work and that they create.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, there's lots of tools to do that. And, a lot of it depends on where you are in the entrepreneurial journey. Do you have a budget? Do you have sales? Are you bootstrapping? Do you have investment? What is your product? What is your market? What is your exit strategy? All of those things factor into coming up with an IP strategy that makes sense for you. And that's why it's always a good idea to, no matter what kind of business you're involved with or planning to be involved with, you at least make a phone call to an IP professional. And, you know, usually the first call is complimentary.
Okay.
And certainly our first calls are complimentary. And just talk to them about what your plans are. You don't have to give away any big secrets. I mean, even though you're protected by the attorney-client privilege, you know, you may not feel comfortable just because you don't know the person that you're talking to.
Right.
You can talk in generalities and they'll be able to give you some ideas and steer you into some directions. So, but the first step is really just to talk with a professional, spend a little time online, Educating yourself is also a way to do it. But reading articles is not going to help you come up with a strategy. Right. And the value of having a professional, as you well know, is that we've seen thousands of different fact patterns over the years. We've worked with the patent office thousands, if not tens of thousands of times. We've worked with the trademark office thousands of times. The Library of Commerce and the Copyright Office, we've worked with them. We've been in the courts and we've seen lots of projects and we know what is practical and would probably work, and we know what is impractical and would be a waste of time and money. So you get a lot of, it's not just knowing the rules, it's knowing how the system works. And so if you manage to connect with an experienced attorney, they'll be able to ask the right questions and get the right information for you. And So I would say the first, there's four types of intellectual property that you need to know about, okay. Right? So patents, they protect inventions and technology, okay. Right? Tangible things, software too, but
okay. So software can be patented.
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. That's like 20% of our practice is software.
Oh, I thought like the code gets copywritten. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, you can do that.
Right.
But you got to do it the right way.
Right.
You don't put your whole code into the copyright office. What you do is,
because then people will see it. Right.
Right. And so.
Whoops. Yeah.
Don't do that.
Right.
You put the first 50 lines in and the
it's
last.
Like copywriting 50 lines the Coca-Cola in. Formula, right? It's right there. Okay.
I don't think they've copyrighted the
Coca-Cola. No, they didn't, because they don't want it to be public, right?
No, that's the trade secret. And right. But yeah, so again, don't try this at home, folks.
Right. Yeah.
You know, well. And filing a copyright with all your code, if you ever did want to patent it, triggers the 1 year. Statutory bar on filing a patent application.
Oh, there you go.
Talk about that later.
But yeah. Okay. Well, make a note if you're listening.
If you're going to file a patent, you have to file it in time before public disclosures, and you have 1 year after the first public disclosure to file your patent. So filing your code at the Copyright Office is a public disclosure.
When you say you have a year, you mean you have to do it within the year, or you have to wait a year?
Within the year.
Okay. So you've triggered that statute, basically.
Right.
Okay.
Now, so the other thing, though, you can do if you want to talk about your project and you don't want to trigger that bar is to get a confidentiality agreement.
Right,
get an NDA.
Right. Yeah.
And you can go on the internet and get those. Some NDA is better, even if it's not a perfect one, is better than no NDA.
Right.
Sometimes there's times that you want to customize it, in which case you would go to Mitch or myself. And if you have multiple entities that you have to cover, you want to limit it to certain types of things, then you need a professional to talk it through with you. But if it's you're meeting with your designer and it's pretty simple, I would still always recommend getting an attorney involved, but if you want to save a few bucks, then you can do that.
And but don't be penny wise and pound foolish. I mean, there's always issues with designers, right? They're designing a logo for you, whatever. You pay them, and then they're claiming that it's their artwork. Well, you better have an agreement that says
you
owns
better,
it, right?
Absolutely, I'm 100%.
Yeah.
And so anyway, the patents protect technology and trademarks protect brands.
Okay.
So Coca-Cola is the most famous brand in the world, and they have gazillions of trademarks on all the different ways they've used it. And it's a famous mark. But the trademarks, registered trademarks, you can register them in the U.S. and you can register them internationally if you decide to work overseas, but that protects your brand.
Okay.
And then copyrights protect works of expression, which are songs, music and songs,
books,
TV shows,
right.
Books, novels. Copyright arises as soon as you create the work.
Right. It doesn't have to be registered in the Library of Congress for it to be a copyright. You
right.
wrote it.
You, then just get it automatically.
Okay.
And there are advantages to registering a copyright.
Okay.
But you don't have to.
Okay.
You still get some protection just by virtue of.
So there's certain statutory protection that you get if you register?
Well, you get a couple of things. One is that you get statutory damages.
Okay.
And what that means is that if you sue an infringer, the court.
Somebody who stole your material, right?
Somebody who stole your material.
Right. Okay.
Thief,
yeah.
And if you take the thief to court, the judge can order a set amount of damages each time your work was improperly used.
You don't even have to prove damages.
You don't have to prove damages, which is a big, big advantage in litigation. And as Mitch, I'm sure, knows that proving damages in a copyright case, it can be really hard.
Right.
And so in this case, the law says you automatically get this money for each violation of the copyright. And so a registration is only, I don't know, it's like $45, $75. And so if you have it registered and a problem does come up, then you have that. And you need a copyright registration to bring suit.
And I was going to ask you a question. I'd heard, I don't know if this is true, you could copyright like a collection of work. So if you were doing artwork for a book, you could copyright all the artwork in a collection, or no?
Yeah, they're getting a little, it's kind of funny. Their copyright office lately has been going in two different directions. They're making it harder to put works together. Traditional
works.
They
want the fees, probably.
Yeah. And on the other hand, social media users
right.
who want to register blog posts or Instagram or Facebook posts can register up to 50 for one fee. Oh. So it's sort of like, on the one hand, they're taking the professionals and making
right.
them pay more money
right.
by making it harder.
All the do-it-yourselfers, they give them an advantage.
Yeah, but all the bloggers and everybody else, you can't do it with podcasts. Sorry, Mitch.
Okay.
But so there are some restrictions, but that was a new law that came out in August. And,
right. But you could, I don't know why you would do this, but you could copyright the podcast content. I don't know why you would do that, but you just trademark the name of the podcast. I have a trademark pending for the podcast, but.
Yeah. I mean, you could. The question is.
Like why?
Is somebody going to use it in a way that would cause you economic injury?
Yeah, so, probably and, not. Yeah.
Yeah, probably not. I mean, yeah. In most cases, you want it to be out there.
Yeah.
You want people to be sharing your podcast, right? Because that helps you.
Right.
But exactly. If you were to the point where this turned out to be a huge moneymaker instead of just a small moneymaker,
right.
but a huge moneymaker,
right.
then it makes more sense now. If people are taking clips and they're claiming that they're Mitch, then
That's problematic.
You would want to stop.
I'd blow up my deal with Spotify for $50 million. Yeah. Okay. And then, so then you said there were four things though, right?
Right. So we did copyrights. We did trademarks. That was the Coca-Cola stuff. We did the patents.
Right.
And finally is trade secrets, right?
Okay.
And so trade secrets are a pretty kind of misunderstood, but they're still valuable IP tools. It's basically a trade secret is anything that's secret that gives you a commercial advantage. So
makes sense.
Lots of times, like recipes, you might want to.
We were saying the Coca-Cola formula, right?
Right. That was
trade
a trade secret.
Exactly.
Perfect.
Yeah, and, because you'd be an idiot to copyright that because everybody would know what the formula says. Right.
But you didn't give that advice.
No.
No. You said
and obviously
that was,
they didn't get that advice.
That was a bad idea. That was
right.
That would not be a
little malpractice
issue. Super smart move. Right. But we know that you would never do that. So,
but do you have some sort of protection because they're trade secrets, or do you have to have an agreement in place?
No, it just arises automatically. But what you have to do is you have to prove that it was a secret and that you intended to keep it secret. So you have to have internal processes. The hardest part about a trade secret case is proving that it was actually kept secret. So if you have something that you want to claim as a trade secret, then you have to take affirmative steps to make it secret. You have to, in the olden days, you'd write trade secret on the folder and then put it in a locked cabinet and write trade secret on the cabinet. And you take pictures of it and say, see, this is a trade secret. Nowadays, it's all about security and data and limiting it to need-to-know basis, but they can be very valuable. Dow Corning Corporation had their basic process as a trade secret, and that was the process that they used to make the materials that they sell.
Yeah, Corningware was a thing, right?
Yeah, I mean, that was Corning. And so they kept the manufacturing part of that a secret, so none of their competitors would know what they were doing. And and then if you have a trade secret and somebody leaves, an employee leaves, and they take their secret, they take your secret and they tell somebody else, then you can take steps to stop that.
Here's a word from our sponsors. Uplift your marketing and reinforce your brand with a digital business card from Digital Accelerant. Use a text marketing combination to stand out in front of your competition. Digital business cards make you memorable and most of all help you bring in new business through its warm lead generator. Motion graphics, intro, outro, and inspirational videos can be added during setup. Text the word LAW to 21000, that's L-A-W to 21000, to learn how to get your own digital business card. Suffering from slow internet speed? Worried about hackers? Fetch Pro gets the internet from your smartphone to your Windows and Mac computer without paying for a hotspot. Always get the fastest, most stable, and secure internet access on your computer with Fetch Pro. Follow their affiliate link on our website to learn more and get connected with Fetch. Printify is the online service that simplifies and automates the process of sourcing and creating print-on-demand products branded with your company logo, product, or service. Printify is a better alternative to pre-purchasing and warehousing your merchandise for distribution or sale. Follow their link from our website to learn how to set up your own online store. And be sure to visit our online store and get yourself some podcast merch. Follow the link in the show notes to learn more about all of our sponsors. And now back to our show.
So it applies not just to manufacturing, but like customer lists. If you have a client list or a customer list.
Right. Have to have, though, something in writing with the employee? So if you had a trade secret, you can't claim this to be a trade secret, but you didn't have an agreement with the employee, non-compete, non-disclosure, non-client stealing, non-circumvent. If you didn't have any of those agreements in place, is there statutory protection anyway?
Yeah. I mean, as long as you intend to keep it, you know, secret, you get the trade secret. But all of the things you mentioned are best practices.
Right. It's obviously easier if you had an agreement that says, signed this. It shows that it's a trade secret.
Right. Yeah. This person signed this and said they weren't going to steal any of our stuff, but they did.
Right. Yeah.
You know, that makes your case easier.
I think people don't think a lot about clients. I even have small businesses like hair salons where they have their stylist sign non-competes and no client stealing agreements, because they know that, I mean, listen, if you want to open 20 miles away, fine, but don't walk down the street, start a salon and take all of your customers with you. It's going to cause damage, and they have them sign those types of things.
Yeah. And, you know, in terms of enforceability and everything, I mean, you know, I'm sure, you know, there's limits to how far you can go with those.
Yeah. These people do like 5 miles in a year, so you can still get a job. You
know, right.
It's enough to keep you from working down the street. But yeah, but I think people don't think about that till it's too late. And it's not, you and I both know, it's hard to have an employee sign those kind of agreements after they're employed, because it lacks a lot of consideration. Just that they're going to fire you is not enough consideration. So you got to give them a bonus or something. You should have had them sign it when they started working, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you want to make sure that you have, as part of the package that you send over to that new employee, you have that employment agreement.
Right.
And you have it set up right. And
a lot of small business owners skip that step. They don't think about it. It's unfortunate.
Yeah, well,
so, you know, big companies.
If you get burned once, then you think about
That's what does it. Yeah, that's exactly what does it. They get burned. Why do you think the salon I have does that? Because they got burned one time. I didn't do it for them. I met them and I do work for them now, you know. So now, what about
your hair, too?
Yeah,
they do your hair?
Yeah, well, I pay them for it, but yeah.
Do you a discount?
Well, sometimes we trade services if they need work and I need haircuts. But what about service marks? How does that differ from trademarks?
It's really not legally, I mean, that's a good
question.
Same thing? People ask me that all the time. There's really legally no difference except service marks protect services. Trademarks protect products. The case law.
It's not like I thought a service mark was like a tagline and a trademark was the name of the company. Obviously not. I'm completely wrong.
In trademark world, we call a tagline a tagline.
Okay.
You can trademark those too, depending on the words. So if you want to trademark something, you have to make sure that it's not descriptive. So if I had wanted to open a law firm called Richard's Law Firm,
right?
But I happen to be Richard,
right?
I couldn't get a trademark on Richard's
Law Firm. No, because another Richard could open Richard's Law Firm if he's a lawyer, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah. And
I've also seen some where you get a trademark, but they want you to disclaim the use of a generic word, like it, you know what I mean? Like if it's called the Beinhacker Law Firm, they might give you a trademark for the Beinhacker Law Firm, but you got to disclaim the use of the word law, that it's not specific to you. I've seen those from, right?
Yeah. All the time. People ask for disclaimers and the trademark examiner does. And
it's fine. Right?
Normally just you go ahead and do it. I mean, it's usually just the common words in the mark and it's not the meaty part of the mark. So it doesn't really make a difference when you're trying to enforce it.
Right. Like the accidental entrepreneur. I'm not going to get a trademark on accidental and entrepreneur. They're just general common words, but together means something.
Right.
You know?
Right. And especially, and you have to remember the goods play a big role in, or the services, if you're getting a service mark, they all play a big role in, whether a trademark is descriptive. So if you said Richard's Law Firm for donuts, you could probably get a trademark called Richard's Law Firm for donuts because it's not for legal
specific
services.
Right.
And so there's a famous case, the Lexus case, where Lexus is a legal
the car
software
company?
And versus Lexus the car company.
Because Lexus is you're talking about LexisNexis, the law firm. That's L-E-X-I-S, right?
Right.
Okay.
And Lexus is with a U-S, right? But in the world of trademarks, those tiny little differences don't
matter. No, because it's the issue of potential confusion, right? Isn't that one of the factors? Okay. I know a little bit about this stuff, see?
Yeah, you do. You know a lot, actually.
It rubs off when I spend time with you. So,
the test is sight, sound, and meaning. Are the marks the same? You know, do they have the same, they look the same, sound the same,
right,
and mean the same? I'm not sure what Lexus means. Probably something
some
in
Japanese word
Latin,
or something, right?
I don't know. But Lex could be law, right? But anyway, two people can have the same trademark or essentially the same trademark for the same goods. Right. So, or for different goods.
For different goods. Different category.
Right. For different categories. So you can have Lexus for cars. You can also have it for legal software.
Okay.
And
that's what happened in that case.
And the court upheld that it's okay to have the same name in two different categories. So I could have Richard's Donuts or Richard's Law Firm for donuts, or I could have Richard's Donuts for a law firm name if they let me do that in New Jersey. I don't think they would. But it would be a great way to attract
business. But you know, they did just recently rule, though, that we now can have non-attorney names for law firms.
Trade names.
About 2 weeks ago, the Supreme Court came down, just like CPA firms. So I think you're going to see trademarking being done in our profession as time goes on. We could be the Ace Law Firm, and Ace is not the name of one of the partners. Yeah.
Well, it used to be that... Well, when I first started, I wanted to open Gearhart Law, and I wanted, but I didn't want to call it Gearhart Law. I wanted to call it Patents Express.
Yeah, now you'll be able to do that.
And I could, but then when you look at the word patents express, it looked like patents sex press.
Oh yeah, that's.
And I just thought that that would not work.
So you didn't try.
So we dropped that completely.
That's funny. Well, that's what you're going to see going forward. It's going to be different.
Yeah, and
it used to be had to be one of our names, right, or a dead partner.
Right.
And
so if you really like somebody, you go out and kill them and then.
Yeah, there you go. Well, I knew a guy who was in the marketing space. He had an advertising company and it was called Bogart Delafield Ferrier. And he did that to, well, he liked Humphrey Bogart. I don't know where Delafield came from. He was the only guy, but he named the practice or the business, because he wasn't a lawyer. He didn't have those issues. You know, from a marketing, he was using it from a marketing standpoint. So we're going to see some interesting things in our space, I think.
Well, for me, we do actually have trademarks on Gearheart Law, and
sure you do. And your name though fits really well in your space.
Yeah,
gear. Yeah. You know, it's like gear, machinery, heart, and stuff. Yeah, exactly.
You know, technology with a heart. That's
right.
Kind
there
of
you
our,
go. I'm sure thing, Elizabeth has a know. Field day with that.
Yeah. So.
So let's talk about what makes a mark. You know, strong, because I know that just because you and I file a trademark on our name and we haven't even started in business doesn't mean that we have a lot of protection, right? You got to use it.
Right. So that's a big part. And if you're a starting entrepreneur and the branding piece is super important to you, you can actually file a trademark before you start using it in commerce.
Right.
And it's called an intent to use application.
Okay.
It's the same cost as a regular trademark application.
Which is what, $225, $250?
Yeah, $275.
Something like that, yeah.
Something like that. And
that
then,
does not include the legal fees to pay your lawyer to do it.
It's just
the application
fee. The fee is usually the smaller part. But
right.
But in any case, you can file it on intent to use basis, and you can sort of put yourself in line. But at the end of the day, trademark law is all about who used the mark first in commerce.
Okay.
And so it's not who files first. Filing first gives you some advantages, but they're, you know, it basically prevents other people who are filing intent to use marks from getting your mark first.
So if you file the intent to use, and then I started using the mark, not knowing you or knowing what the mark is, I would not be barred from using it?
That's a complicated legal question.
Okay.
It does definitely mark your place in line. And then you want to use the mark as quickly as you can.
And is there a limit, like at a point where the application dies, if you don't use it by a certain date?
You get 3 years.
Oh, and that's
then
a long time.
You renew it every 6 months. And so there's a fee for that. And you're paying, you know, if you're using a firm, you know, you're paying for that too.
I can't. Well, what are you going to do? Yeah, it's been 3 years. You haven't used the mark yet. What? Use it.
Yeah, it's time to kind of, you can always reapply, you know.
Right, okay.
You know, if somebody else hasn't taken it. But.
Now, let's say I started using a mark and 2 years from now, I file a trademark on the mark. Maybe I put a TM, right? That's a common law trademark by my name. Does my application go retroactive to my date of use, my first date of use?
Absolutely. And doing a trademark is not necessarily one of the first things you have to do, but you do have to do a trademark search early in the process, because many times we'll have clients who come to us and they've been using a mark for a couple of years.
Right.
And somebody
with no registration. Meaning they have no registration. They've just been using
it. Yes, no registration. And somebody with a registration in California sees their website and says, wait a minute, I've got a trademark on that. Stop. And you've spent a lot of time and energy investing in your brand.
Right.
And now you either have to duke it out and lit court, or you have to pay a license fee, or you have to change your branding. So getting a trademark search done by a competent professional is really, really important when you're starting your business. Even if you know, if you work with Gearhart Law, we charge $2,500 for the whole process. It depends on what your budget is.
Right.
But it's not hundreds of thousands of dollars, right?
Right.
And so the search part of that is $700, right? So at least do the search part and make sure that you're picking a name that is not going to be problematic. And I can go on and on and on with stories about people who filed their own trademarks. They didn't do a trademark search. They maybe even got their own trademark, and then they find out later a trademark can be challenged after it's issued. And so if you don't do the search and there's somebody else out there before you, and the examiner doesn't pick up on it.
Oh, that happens. You mean like they have a trademark in the database, you file an application and it still gets approved?
Oh yeah. I have that issue right now with a client. We're fighting an opposition, which is a litigation proceeding at the trademark office. He filed for his name a couple of years after. We warned him about this other company, but it was a very small company at the time. And he decided to assume the risk and move forward with his name because he was infatuated with it. And 5 years later, the company got $100 million in funding and went public. And now they're chasing him because the names are too similar.
Right.
And fortunately, we've been able to negotiate a pretty good agreement with the opposing side. But, you know, that was a, you know, he filed on his own first, and then he came to us and we said, so getting that, and that's like hundreds of thousands of dollars later in litigation.
Oh, really?
Well, I don't know.
It was a lot more than just the search. Yeah. That's for sure.
And, you know, but it's going to cost him hundreds of thousands of dollars. He has to change part of his name, not all of his name. That was the victory. He gets to keep the first part, which is the strong part, but he has to change the back part, which is, and he has to go through a whole rebranding process. So it is going to cost him hundreds of thousands of dollars to fix the problem. And so, I can tell you another interesting story. So this person who wasn't a client became client later.
Right.
He had purchased a furniture store.
Okay.
And the attorney who did the due diligence on the furniture store purpose didn't check the trademark register. So if you're buying or selling a business, you got to check the trademarks to make
sure. Buyers. Yeah, you should.
Yeah. So this guy he bought the furniture store from had been in business for 25 years. The owner was old school, never had a website. So as soon as he bought the business, he put his website up. And there was a guy in Maryland who had a trademark, same name, same type of company. He was 100% dead. And he bought that, spent $5 million for that business and eventually had to change the name. Because, and, you know, of course, all the goodwill of 25 years of selling in the community is out the window, right? So it's important to make sure that you get that stuff done. And I'm glad I wasn't the attorney who did the deal for him because, you know, that can be really painful to hear that from a client, you know? So
now I guess you also want normally in those purchase agreements, we put representations from the seller that they have the right to a name that you can do your own searches, what do? You go back and sue the seller. It's going to cost you more money, more time and aggravation.
Yeah.
You know, avoid it. I want to ask you this though. Tell me a little bit of a sales pitch for you, but why just like going out and, I mean, you can go to the USPTO.org website, right? You can do a basic search of the trademarks and you could do a Google search. Why is that not necessarily sufficient? Because obviously for $700, they're not doing a Google search.
No, we have a special subscription database that compiles trademarks in a particular way.
Okay.
And we do a federal search. If the client wants to spend additional money, we can do sort of a scorched earth type of search where we not only check the federal trademark register, but we check state trademark registers, we check URLs, we check business names, We really just
much more comprehensive.
Yeah, much more comprehensive. For most entrepreneurs, a federal trademark search is enough. But for if the brand is really important, then we'll do the scorched earth search. So what's the difference? Well, the main difference is just we have seen so many trademarks, and we know how the trademark office interprets these things. You may not know whether a mark is suggestive or descriptive. Suggestive is okay, descriptive is not. We have done enough work with the trademark office that we know whether that mark is going to be considered suggestive or descriptive. Not 100%,
right?
But we have pretty good instincts because that's all we do.
Right.
And is it going to be confusingly similar to another mark? That's another thing they reject them for.
Right.
And, because we know what happens if the process goes wrong, we can discourage a very enthusiastic entrepreneur from making a stupid mistake. And so those things are important. And then after the mark gets filed, we have databases that track everything that's going on. We report to you regularly about with correspondence when something comes in. We remind you that this decision is due at a certain point. Will you please give us an answer? Do you want to do this? Do you want to do that? And so we stay on top of it for you, so you don't have to worry about it.
Right.
You file a trademark yourself, you get a paper, you have 6 months to answer it. And then, we get many clients who filed themselves. They get an office action response. It goes abandoned because you only get one notice from the trademark office. Right. And they forget about it. It's 6 months away.
Right.
And, but we don't, we have a reminder system set up so that we're nagging you to get, make a decision, whether it's a go forward or drop it, whatever it is. We nag you until you make up your mind. And so that's part of the service as well. And we also have watch services. So if you have a trademark and you want to be able to monitor what other trademarks are being issued or out on the market, then we can take steps to advise you. Sometimes we can intervene and prevent the other trademark from being issued. So there's a lot of advantages that we know how to get around the rejections. We know when to disclaim it. We know when to fight it. We know how to write the description of goods so it covers what you have now and what will work in the future.
Right.
And so all of those things are, if you want strong trademark protection, that's what you need. If you don't care about those things, I go to LegalZoom. I mean, I send people out too much money. Well,
right.
Okay.
What else are you going to tell them? I know. I do the same thing
Zoom
sometimes.
Or do it yourself. Call
the
trademark office.
I can't do it cheaper than that. Right.
And they'll help you out.
You know,
if you don't think that kind of advice is worth the money, then I'm fine with that.
Right.
I'm not going to try to push you into something that you don't want.
I think people don't realize how much, though, intellectual property touches their life. You get a lot of people where they'll set up a website and they'll pull photos offline that they think are free, or they have a designer do it. And then they get a letter from Getty Images that tells them they're infringing and they take it down and we want a fee for $5,000. Like, what? I didn't pay $5,000 for the whole website. You know, you get a lot of that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And, those fees can usually be negotiated now.
Yeah, right.
I'm
of course,
sure
I've negotiated a lot of them away.
Why go there in the first place?
Right. Well, you want your designer. Look, that's when it comes down to contracts. You want a contract with your designer that says that anything they're using, they have the right to use, and make sure that they do. Because sometimes you can't check yourself. They're putting up photographs on it. Or go to one of these services, Shutterstock or iPhoto, and purchase the photos.
Right.
But read the fine print. Some of those purchases are right. Aren't some of those the right to use licenses are a little off? You think you're buying this thing you put up anywhere and you find that it's a limited license for print only or something like that.
Right.
You got to read the fine print. That's usually why you use a lawyer.
Right. And if you're using professional photographers, they all have different philosophies and approaches, you know, okay, this headshot that I did for you can only be used on your website. If you want to put it in a brochure, you have to pay extra.
Right.
Right. And
read what you sign.
Yeah. So make sure you know, what the charges are, and unless you just have lots of money and don't care.
Right. Well, I don't know anybody that has lots of money and doesn't care. I know people have a lot of money. Usually the people that have the money are the ones that care. Let me ask you this question, because I've run into this recently where I have a small business and they have a name. You know, it's not Coca-Cola, but they have a name to the business. Maybe they filed a certificate with the county. They didn't even file a trademark, but it's in use. And they're breaking up, right? They're liquidating the business and maybe arguing about it. They have a website. They have a name. They have social media accounts. What happens with that property? Where does it go? You can't split it up. It's not like a bank account where you could split a dollar into 50 cents and 50 cents.
Yeah, I mean, so that's a common law trademark. Most businesses, whether they know it or not, have common law trademark rights because trademarks accrue by use. And common law trademarks extend to any place where you've done business. So if you've done business in three states, you would get... common law trademark rights in three states.
Right.
Usually it's more local.
Okay.
But it's a asset like any other asset of the company. The owners could agree to, let each other use the name.
Right.
If they were going to go after different markets or if they were going to work in different geographic areas, or they could decide that the goodwill is going to be owned by one of them. And it's just like any other asset that's negotiated.
And now what happens if I have one right now? It's a bakery and I don't think they're going to agree. Now, one of the guys I think owns, he bought. So I don't know if there was a county, there was definitely nothing filed with the state. It was a DBA. So let's say it was called, the bake shop and they started using the croissant shop as their DBA, as an alternate name. Wasn't filed with the state, apparently. Right. And they didn't have a trademark in this case. So they're fighting over what to use. So the one guy went out, I think, and formed an LLC called the Croissant Shop in New Jersey because it was available. It wasn't filed anywhere. So can the other person block him or her from using that name? They're dissolving the business. The business is going to dissolve.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know the answer to that.
Very facts and circumstance,
but it's an asset. So it's like the croissant machine. Who gets it?
Right.
If somebody goes in there and steals it at night and walks off with it and puts it in their bake shop,
gotta sue them.
Then there's laws around that it's a type of theft, right?
Right.
And
of course.
So it's the same thing with intellectual property.
Because I guess you could sell the name in theory and then split the money up, right? It's the same thing as selling
you could do that.
The machine.
Yeah. So it's just an asset of the business like any other asset. It's a little different because it's intangible, right?
Right.
So it's not like the donut machine or the croissant machine where it's there and, who possesses it and it's on what property and, usually you would do some sort of accounting and you would say, okay, I put in the money and I bought this machine, so it's mine. Or, I was the chief marketing person and I spent all my time marketing and I'm the one that built up the reputation and the goodwill of the shop. So I have a better claim to the trademark. And you would,
that's how you argue it out,
or you'd settle it in court, hopefully not.
Right. But no, because the name itself probably doesn't have a lot of value on the street, but to you and to your partner, both of which have worked in this store and feeling like, well, I want to continue the store and not with you. It's valuable to the two of you, but nobody else. So it's got no intrinsic value.
Well, that's not necessarily true. I mean, people buy goodwill all the time. And, companies buy other companies and part of what they're buying is
the name,
the name of the company, right? They may completely change everything. So, I only say that because you know, as business owners, I wouldn't want them to think, well, our name is not worth anything. It may not be worth anything, but it could
to
be
to other people. Right. It might still be worth something to you. And it brings up an interesting point, because when it comes to like buy sell agreements and what do you do if you want to leave the business, I found over the years, a lot of them don't address intellectual property specifically. No. And it probably should. Social media accounts, websites, telephones, names, something I'm going to address going forward when I do them for people.
Yeah.
You can't split those up.
No.
Yeah.
No, breaking up is hard to do.
Well, speaking of that, I appreciate all your time spending with me and the valuable information you've given to people. We'll put your contact information in the show notes. You had mentioned that, you know, you're available for a short free consult if somebody has an issue they want to run by you.
Yeah, basically what happens is people call and I talk on and on and on. And I give them, too. You know, just I talk to them about what they need. And then usually, you know, we say it's a half hour, but yeah,
I do too, but it always goes more than that.
Sometimes it's a little more, sometimes a little less. So.
Right, exactly. If you like the podcast, please tell others about us. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, on Google Podcasts, on Amazon Music, and many of the other podcast directories. If you like what you hear, please leave us a 5-star review and feel free to share our episodes on social media. If you have any questions or comments, ideas for the show, or you'd even like to appear as a guest, reach out to us by email at info@beinhackerlaw.com. The Accidental Entrepreneur is hosted and produced by me, Mitch Beinhacker. If you'd like more information about my legal services, you can find me on social media or visit my website at beinhackerlaw.com. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe to our feed to be notified of all future episodes.